In landmass, Oregon's 2nd congressional district is huge. It's the second largest district in the whole country that is not an entire state. The 2nd district touches the borders of California, Nevada, Idaho, and Washington, running from Grants Pass to Minnehaha, nearly 600 miles away. One person represents it, and he's retiring. Greg Walz's decision not to run for re-election in the 2nd District makes for a rare open seat. This week and next at this time, we visit with the major party candidates for Congress in Oregon's CD2. Today, we get the Republican candidate. Cliff Bentz is a former state senator, state representative, and Water Resources Commission member. He's a lawyer and farmer from Ontario near the Idaho border. And our guest, Senator Bentz, thanks for joining us on the Jefferson Exchange.
Well, thank you for having me on your show.
It's a pleasure. When we talked to you before the primary, you said that with President Trump in office, Republicans had a friend in the White House and we need to take advantage of it. The trajectory in that race has changed a bit since we last spoke. I wonder if it's got you thinking any differently about your own pursuit of the seat in Congress.
Well, no, but it would be sad after I spent 12 years in Salem, never a day in the majority. To go to Washington, D.C. and find myself in somewhat the same place. I knew the chances of us, we Republicans, flipping the House in D.C. were modest. There was a path, there still is. But it now appears that the White House is a toss-up, so we'll see. But my hope is that President Trump wins and retains his position, and that will enable me to do a lot more to help CD2.
Let's talk about number one issues. I know what you said back in May, or before the primary in May, but things may have changed a bit. What is the number one issue on your list now?
Well, of course, it's protecting people in this COVID crisis, which is very different in its effect upon people across the district. Of course, in your folks' part of the district, fire is still the big issue. It's a big issue, I think, when we spoke before, forest management. And the COVID situation is growing worse, and the challenge is how do we manage our way through what is probably another 6 months or a year before we can put this behind us, we all hope. And so that's probably very close to the top.
Mm-hmm. And you talked back then about wanting to make sure that freedoms get protected as we deal with the virus. I mean, how do we protect basic values and freedoms and yet be able to at least persuade people to change their behaviors enough to keep too many people from getting sick and filling up the hospitals?
Well, you know what? I think what's happening, it started out that way. It was a basic freedom issue. Now it's starting to be more, I think you see it, fatigue, weariness with being careful, weariness with not being social. And I think that's the issue now. People are just tired of not having the opportunity to go out and go to church like they used to, or go, you know, down to the local tavern for a beer, and they can't. And that's starting to wear on people, and that's probably what I think we're seeing happening across the world. People are just getting really tired of it. And it's a real, no longer is it just freedom. It's now a lot of people just kind of getting fatigued with the whole thing. And the challenge is going to be, we've got another 5-6 months of a real challenging times, and people need to understand that.
So as a leader seeking a greater leadership position, what do you recommend? I mean, how do you inspire people to shake off the fatigue and put shoulder to wheel, nose to grindstone, your metaphor here?
Yeah. Well, what I try to do is say to people, look, wearing a mask is a challenge and difficult, but if you want to be safer, not necessarily totally safe, you better wear one. And if you want to keep other people safer, you better wear one. I say that because this is like so many things. It's on all of us. It's kind of like this election. You better vote. Don't rely on everybody else. Go vote. And so the same is true for this virus. And it's challenging because it's so different in its impact on different places. So for example, in Harney County, they had one case. I'm not sure whether they've got more now, but 2 months ago, one case. And so telling everybody to wear a mask in Harney County, you kind of go, well, why? Mm-hmm. And so being more refined in how we approach this is really, really necessary. So having an education kind of an explanation to everybody of how dangerous their situation is, so that they can in turn make the right decision when it comes to wearing masks. And in other places where there isn't the virus, then, well, not so much. But a lot of that comes down to how are you going to educate people up on exactly what their degree of risk is. And we could go on about this for quite a while, but there's some very good thinking going on in this space. I've referred people to the governor's chief of staff, Nick Blosser, folks that are relying on studies out of Stanford on how to be more precise in risk assessment so that we can be, you know, not telling everybody when there's one case in a county of 10,000 square miles to wear masks. People are just going to kind of look at you. On the other hand, in a place like Medford, Grants Pass, where I understand cases are starting to creep up, better be careful.
Yeah, Jackson County hit a daily record yesterday, but then I was looking at the list of Oregon counties and discovered that Malheur, where you live, has actually got more cases total than Jackson County, which surprised me. Umatilla has more cases than Lane County because of a couple of outbreaks there, so it is not just an urban area thing by a long shot.
It's not, but I would point out that in both cases, both in Malheur County, where I've lived for a long time, and in Umatilla County, there are there are high levels of low income people who don't have the luxury of large homes and don't have the luxury of having everybody live apart, and that causes a much more likely transmission situation. I also know here in Malheur County we're immediately adjacent to Idaho, and Idaho took an entirely different approach, and they're now seeing some very, very challenging consequences. And we're immediately adjacent to Idaho, but we don't count Idaho residents as cases, so I'm not suggesting that everybody that's counted in Malheur County just came over from Idaho. That's not true, but the transmission issues are there.
Senator Bence, let's talk about what the federal government can do. I mean, obviously it's doing a lot to try to instruct people on proper procedures during the pandemic, but economically, if you were in Washington now, is there any one of the various versions of another COVID relief bill that you would vote yes on?
Right. Well, I'm not sure. I'm not that familiar with the current relief bill. Let me simply say this. There are people who need help, and we have to identify them and then figure out how to help them. The challenge, and I learned this in talking to some of the farmers in the district over here just a couple of days ago, in fact, is not to incentivize people not to work, because that's what happened the last time around, and it was very, very difficult for people that own a farm or rent a farm and are trying to run it to find people to work, because they were getting paid so much not to work. And so that's not good, because you've got to plant your crops during a short defined window of time. And if nobody's going to come to work, it's not going to work very well for you. And so we've got to be very careful in how we do this. This is not to undersell the need. There's need. And that also takes us into rent and rent relief and into not only when we're going to go on a, you know, a rent forgiveness holiday, we've got to figure out how to protect the landlords so they can pay to make their payments to the bank. I mean, it needs to be carefully thought out, much more so than was the case before. By the way, I'm not suggesting they didn't do everything right the time before. The best thing they did is they did something that kept us out of a very severe recession, and I'm happy for that.
Mm-hmm. How do you feel about the support for state governments, which has been a major holdup, it seems like?
Right. So... In my 12 years in Salem, I had many opportunities to talk about the incredible misdesign of our public employee retirement system, the PERS system, which now is dramatically underfunded. And it's much better than other states. I thank goodness we're not like other states. You know, Illinois, for example, or perhaps New York, where they are in deep trouble by failing to appropriately fund some of their public employee retirement plans. The difficulty is that those plans are flawed. They are deeply flawed, and given the power of public employee unions in Oregon, we can't seem to get them fixed. So the question is, why should we ask the federal government to come in and fund plans that are deeply flawed, and the states refuse to do anything about it? We have a fix for the PERS system, but it's been ignored. And it's been ignored because our public employee unions don't want it to happen, and they have enormous power. And Jeff, this leads me to the votes that we're doing right now on ballot measures. And I would strongly recommend that people are voting and when they're looking at the ballot measure that has to do with campaign finance reform, they ask themselves, would this apply to unions? Because I'll tell you, it won't. Why? Because the people who would make those laws are controlled by the unions, and they're not going to limit union money in campaign. And that makes it that much more difficult to try to fix things like PERS. But anyway, your question was, should we bring money out of the federal government to bail out programs like PERS? And I think the short
answer, I wasn't asking about PERS specifically. I'm talking about the fact that obviously you have to have balanced budgets at the states, and then your income drops at the time that the need increases in things like a recession.
Right. Okay. So good point, and thank you for clarifying. What I would say is that when you look at states and you ask what is it that causes them to be in trouble, what have they been doing that means their budgets are in trouble? And I would simply call out this Oregon's decision to embrace Obamacare and add many, many, many people to the Medicaid rolls without having any clear means of funding it. We stood up on the floor, we Republicans, and we said, hey, where's the money going to come from? Because we knew it wasn't there. And I think it was like $1 billion short when we knew looking forward when we came off the sharing arrangement, or it was reduced by the federal government, that we wouldn't have the money. And so the question is, does the federal government come in now and bail us out of that particular decision, or many others just like it? And again, I'm not suggesting that we shouldn't address health care. We should. But that was a clear case of, well, we're going to go ahead and obligate ourselves, and then we'll go out and, having obligated ourselves, force everybody to pay for it. So that's not correct.
Cliff Benz is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, former state senator running for Oregon Congress, District 2. He is the Republican candidate, therefore favored because of the huge bulge in Republican registrations across the district. You can join our conversation on the exchange with your questions for the candidate at 800-838-3760 on the phone. Email address is jx@jeffnet.org. Let's come back to fire, because apparently you did recently tour the Alameda Fire Zone. Talk about the impressions you came away with, what you think the federal government can do to ease people's suffering in the short term and do some prevention in the long term?
Well, let me just say, I extend my deepest sympathies for the folks that were lost in the fire. Thank goodness, it was just a few, but that's still too many. And also to all the folks who lost their houses. I've never seen anything sadder here in Oregon. I must say, my wife is from Santa Rosa, California, and it's endured three fires like that in the last 4 years. And so it's just horrific to walk through that. And so your question is, what can we do about it? And the answer is, FEMA is down there now. Greg Walden, Congressman Walden, is working closely with staff and he with FEMA to try to accelerate the response. And should I be elected, I would be trying my best to pick up the ball and run with it as he's been doing. There's a huge need there, and I've been actually working with other people to try to find folks that build housing. My son happens to work for a company that builds houses out of those shipping containers and at a very low cost. And so those are the kind of things that we all need to be working for, to try to find temporary or perhaps longer-term housing for people. But FEMA is the one that's charged with doing this, and thank goodness they're down there working at it right now. And whatever we can do to speed it up, we should be doing.
Well, you know, and I hesitate to make the connection this quickly, because Alameda Fire was definitely an urban fire, did not start in a wild area, but we end up talking about wildfires because they are the more prevalent things. And there is a lot of fuel out there. There's little disagreement about that. The disagreement is about what to do about it. What would be the approach you would favor?
Well, you put that very, very nicely. So what I try to do is place the issue before everybody in proper context. And there's between 30 and 40 million acres of timber in Oregon. There's another 30 in California, 40 and 20 or so in Washington State. So close to 100 million acres of timber on the West Coast. In Oregon, we lost about 1 million acres. So we lost about 3 or 4% of our total timber in this summer. That means there's 97% of our timber that's still there to burn. And just put it in perspective. And the question is, what in the world can we do about the massive amount of fuel that's built up over these years where we've kept people out of the woods? And the first thing we have to do is make sure people understand that it didn't have to be this way. There are ways of, over time, of making our forests safer. And we need to start doing it. The challenge is, it's so big. The the comment that I've heard many times is, it's like we're trying to use a tweezer to mow a lawn.
Mm-hmm.
You can't do it in any time fast without starting at all kinds of different fronts. I was talking to some of the tribe members up in the Umatilla, and they were saying, hey, you know, in our forest, we do these little controlled burns, and that's what you should be doing. And I'm going, yay! But little controlled burns, that's going to do a little bit of good. What about logging? That makes some sense. And stop the lawsuits that prevent us from doing some logging, that would do a little bit of good. Well, what about getting into using biomass for energy generation? That would do a little good. And, I mean, we could go on and on, but we've got to do a whole bunch of things, and we've got to do them right. But more importantly, we have to do them now. This waiting around and talking about it isn't going to work. We, the people in Phoenix, not Phoenix and Talent, let's go over to Detroit and the space above Salem that burned up.
Mm-hmm.
Those people, they can't wait. People in Oak Ridge, they can't wait. People in Grants Pass, they can't wait. They're all surrounded by timber. It's really something to drive through there and realize how close they all are to burning up.
Yeah, the trees are right there. But, you know, you get to the same place usually. Environmental groups fear just taking the big trees, and then timber groups fear taking no big trees. I mean, how do you find a spot that does improve forest health, and does it have to include merchantable timber for mills?
I don't think it has to, but it means you got to find the money to pay for it someplace else. I would say that as anybody's talking to environmental organizations, part of defining the problem is showing what happened to people's lungs as they were breathing all that smoke over those weeks and almost months of this summer. And think of all the little kids whose lives have been shortened by virtue of breathing that awful smoke. And you got to say, hey, this is time we all sit down at a table and we figure this out, and we don't leave the room until we have a solution, or at least a partial one.
Now, one of the things you said in talking about management is stop the lawsuits. And I know you have supported changing the National Environmental Policy Act, or NEPA, which requires things like environmental impact statements. I mean, how much do you want to change it?
Well, you still got to know what you're doing before you start doing it. And so these studies are important. The trouble, though, is with an environmental assessment, is that the people who are doing them realize they're going to be sued. The Forest Service will slow down the process because they're busy trying to dot every I, cross every T, and reduce the chances of a successful lawsuit. They still know they're going to get sued. And one of the reasons for the lawsuit, one of the big reasons, is delay. People don't want anything to happen, so they just file a lawsuit, and 2 or 3 years go by, and guess what? No logging, no nothing has happened. And that's their goal. They throw everything against the wall because under the Access to Justice Act, if they're successful in one of those areas, they'll get attorney fees. And so the system is designed incorrectly because it encourages that kind of litigation delay tactic. And so we got to go in and we got to fix that so that the proper motives for lawsuits are trying to get it right as opposed to delay.
Senator Cliff Bentz, former Senator Cliff Bentz, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, running for Oregon Congress District 2, the Republican candidate. We'll have Alex Spencer same time next week. We talked about fire. We talked about timber management. Let's talk about water. You were part of the Oregon Water Resources Commission. We haven't talked yet about the four Klamath River dams proposed for removal. One of them is in Oregon's 2nd District. Thoughts on the process and what you would like to see happen?
So when I went into the legislature years ago, I was actually led the opposition to the removal of the four Klamath River dams. I did so not because those dams were in my district. They were not. I did so because the people of my district, Harney County, Mallacher County, Baker County, Grant County, they did not want to see dams come out because we rely on dams all across the district. And whether it's Snake River dams, the Columbia River dams, the Deschutes River dams, those dams provide incredible benefits for this area and are, frankly, the foundation for many of the communities that exist here in this part of this, and frankly, all across CP2. And so they saw removal of those dams as a kind of a camel's nose in the tent, and so I opposed the dams removal. What I've explained to people down in the Klamath and other places is that my primary point of reference, should I be the congressman, is going to be, what does that community want? What is it that exactly the people of the Klamath want? And I've visited now the Klamath, I want to say 7 times since May, meeting with different people and saying, what do you people want? And a more fractured, community I have never seen, and I mean it. It's really, really sad. So it's sad because it's so hard to bring everybody together after years of litigation and years of arguments and years of fighting over water. And so one of my biggest challenges, should I end up with this job, and I hope I do, is to try to help those people find a way to some sort of a resolution to that situation. And the dams are going to play a big part.
Senator Bence, you signed a pledge to support term limits. Oddly enough, both of the guys running for president are older than you would be after three terms in Congress. I've seen lots of people who support term limits change their minds upon election, and I think you have to be aware of that as well.
Right. So one of the things I've told people repeatedly when I was in the Oregon House and Oregon Senate is that I wish I could pass a law that would make everybody serve in the Oregon House and Oregon Senate. And frankly, how about everybody serve on a school board while we're at it, because I've done that too. Because it's such an education for those of us who think we all know how everything should work. And when you actually get there and you're trying to convince other people of your views, it's really something. And I wish everybody had that opportunity. And so the reason that I support term limits is because I think there's a real good thing happens when you have new people come in. The good thing is that other people think, hey, maybe I can run for that. And they get more involved in politics. And there were 11 people that ran in the Republican primary. 11. Mm-hmm. I was one of 11. And I ended up winning convincingly. And now I've moved on to this race. Of course, there's only two of us now. Well, I guess there's three. But the point is having more opportunity for people to argue and discuss how best to represent themselves is a good thing.
Cliff Bence running for Congress as the Republican in Oregon Congressional District 2. Democrat Alex Spencer will join us next week at the same time. Senator Bence, thank you so much for joining us on the Jefferson Exchange.
Really enjoyed it. Thank you so much.
All right, take care.